Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So we now have an opportunity for 10 minutes Q&A before David Willetts arrives. Can I just remind everybody that because we're being filmed, can you please stand up when you give your question and say who you are, where you come from? Can I encourage our online viewers to use the submit question to chair button on their screen to put those questions through? So can I take a cluster of questions from the floor? Who wants to go first?
That's me again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
Cathy Garner, I'm here as an advisory member for Lancaster University Management School. I'd just like to say I'm delighted to hear the mention of two words, absorptive capacity, because I felt we've lacked that today, because that's a technical term for businesses being able to take on new ideas, take on new technology, etc. And I'd like to use the example of graphene. Mike, I hope you'll forgive me. But I've been asking the graphene issue and the patenting issue. We've been doing some work in Manchester, and I've worked in Manchester for 6 years, and graphene is a tremendous story. But one of the biggest challenges I feel is how do companies in the Manchester area take that leading-edge technology and adapt it to their business? And here is exactly where I see the opportunity that you've been talking about for business schools to come along, because the one constant thing that these businesses have are business problems. And you can bring them together, and you can bring them together with the knowledge transfer and technology transfer initiatives of universities. So I think universities could be less of a constraint, but more of an opportunity. So my question is really for business schools. I know Lancaster does a lot of this, a lot of collaborative. Question for business schools is, do they feel really happy working with their other departments in that knowledge exchange, knowledge transfer, technology transfer? Because I'm sure that we could get the Googles and graphene accelerators if we work together in that area.
I'm assuming as the stand-in business school rep on the panel that's coming to me. I think the answer, if I reflect on quite a number of schools, I'd reflect on another two L's, Loughborough and Leeds, both of which have got large engineering faculties, that we do actually see increasingly close work with colleagues across the engineering field in terms of bringing a distinctive business perspective to their research bids, a perspective I think in some instances provides those bids with added value and assisting them. I think there is a sense perhaps that business schools are perhaps becoming a little bit less high-walled than they once were. And if I reflected on my own school, what is the issue? There's only so many ways you can differentiate a business school within the confines of the business school domain. Partly what allows you to differentiate is the broader institution that you work in and capitalizing on those. And you wouldn't expect anything less from an Aberdonian, but money does matter, and EPSIRC has more money than EPSRC.
Actually, Mike, do you want to respond partly from the in terms of the experience that you're having in Manchester practically in terms of issues around graphene?
So let's talk about graphene for a little bit, and Cathy knows it very well, having been part of the story of graphene. So two or three things happened there. First of all, we retained the two professors, which was primary motivation for us, because as Angus said, there was although companies around the world are investing in graphene 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, so were other governments. And South Korea in particular was putting $160 million into graphene at the time. Even though it was just at the time, it was not really real, if I can put it that way. So we retained those. Second one is there's a stage to go before commercialization, and that's where we are working with small businesses and large businesses. But some want to hold back here's a real example. So graphene is reputed to be, by our tests and our experiments, about 1,000 times faster than any chip known to man. So think of the best chip that Intel or ARM or anybody else can produce. It is way better. The problem is it's about 1,000 times bigger as well. So scale, at the moment, the chip is this kind of size, and we have to reduce the scale down to something that will fit in a mobile phone. And that is a challenge for some businesses. So there's kind of three stages. The second stage, some businesses are saying, let's wait. we don't want to engage yet until after that. And the other stage, the first stage, is people saying, let's get involved in the early exploitation. And that's partly what our regional growth fund bid was about. How do we exploit that in organisations? How do we create an environment which they can get in there, get involved, get change, and make that commercialisation real? And recognising that some of those will fail, and that's fine for us if they don't succeed as a business. Look at the car industry back in the early 20th century. So like 95% of all supplies to the car industry in the early 20th century did not exist 5 years after the first car was produced. And the same goes for any new technology that comes out. They come and they move quickly. So we want to create that cluster around not just Manchester. I reached out to the universities of the northwest of England and said, what are you great at, where graphene could be fantastic for you? And if you know what it is, come and talk to us, and you could lead on aerospace manufacturing or on different technologies. And they've taken us up, Lancaster included, as you know. So it's difficult, but we're halfway there.
No, that's great.
Livingstone, University of the West of Scotland. General question for the panel, or a point perhaps, is that the title of the report is Impact on Business Schools, or sorry, the impact that business schools and the role that business schools have. We've also talked about the role of public sector, and of course we've talked about the role of industry. A couple of themes linked into that. Obviously there's a model that the triple helix, how you manage to get those three sets of entities together, the business schools, public and private. And the two main themes we've heard probably from most speakers are this focus on local, regional dimension to it, as well as the requirement and one of the recommendations from the report about business schools establishing an element of diversity, distinctiveness. So the question I put to the panel is, whilst focusing on projects is important, is it not also important to focus on the process? One of the speakers mentioned about brokerage and perhaps the next step, because we've had a number of reviews dating all the way back. We've heard about the Lambert review a number of years ago, 10 years ago or so, and the current range of reviews. Lord Heseltine mentioned a whole range of organisations involved in this, from trade associations. Surely, for the panel, is the issue now not about how to bring these organisations together in what, in simple terms, looks like three strands of a helix, but actually in reality the process of brokering between the three entities is the big challenge. Not so much doing things with projects, but the focus on process. There's the challenge, is it not?
Okay, Ron, thank you very much. Actually, Lord Heseltine, in terms of bringing those organisations together, as you say, you weren't making particular value judgments, but actually what needs to be done to kind of shake them to get things to work?
Well, there are only two ways to go. The government does it or the private sector does it. In every other country, the government has done it. There are various forms. In Hong Kong, the government works through the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank in order to provide a mentoring service for small businesses. In America, the government does it with the Small Business Administration. On the continent, broadly, the governments do it with a thing called public law status, whereby every company's got to be a member of the chamber, so the chambers are rich and powerful and resourceful. In MITI in Japan, they have a system which actually has much the same sort of effect. So the government can do it, but the government is not going to do it here. So put that out of your mind in any legislative framework. That they might is a perfectly good question. That they should have done is a perfectly good question, but they're not going to do it. So is the private sector going to do it? No, the private sector is not going to do it because you have five warring tribes, and they will fight to the death in order to preserve their independence. The independence they are defending means that they are completely unrepresentative of anything other than the relatively small sector of the private sector itself. So, is there a middle way? Yes, there is a middle way. One of two things. Either the government could stamp its tiny foot and say, we won't put up with this any longer. They could do it with trade associations and say, we will only talk to serious trade associations and everybody else should be under an umbrella and come through them. It can work. I did it and in the 90s, but it didn't last long enough because there's new minister, new initiative, new name on the door, and out goes the old initiatives. But you could do the same if the Department of David's department, frankly, if BIS could agree that the excellent work that Stephen Green is doing on the export side, where there now is a government drive to get the chambers into a meaningful role. Quote, David Cameron went to India where with a major industrial development, a group of industrialists to sell exports. There is no British Chamber of Commerce in India. If by passing through Mumbai you happen to ask what the Germans have got, they've got 100 Germans sitting in Mumbai in the German Chamber of Commerce working like billio for German exporters. So Stephen Green is driving the export side, but the domestic side of the Department of Biz is actually still talking about let there be choice and competition and let the business schools do it or let the chambers do it or let the LEPs be responsible. This is the formula to perpetuate the lacuna that has existed since 1972 when the Devlin report said something should be done. The only alternative is a version of that is that the LEPs stamp their tiny foot and say, I'm sorry, we're not putting up with this absence of an effective private sector voice. And it's very interesting listening to all the conversations about what the business schools should do. Business schools couldn't even get a list of the private companies in their area. They couldn't even get the list because it's not published. Every local authority's got it because they collect the rates, but they don't publish it. So you've got your hands tied behind your back even if you want to approach the cohort as opposed to the tiny fragment that join any one of these named organisations. So the question is dead on course. It is the process. We are amateurs playing in a highly professional world, and the politics of dealing with these amateur organisations are extremely uncomfortable for ministers because each of the organisations I've mentioned has got a very effective two-pronged defence. One is a letter-writing system to members of parliament saying, get off our backs, leave us alone, you know, whatever it may be. And the second is a version of the same straight to one or two of the big national newspapers, say they're suffocating us with new regulation, they're trying to coerce us into doing this, that and the other. And everybody says this is terrible, ignoring the fact that every other advanced economy decades ago has licked this issue and has got an effective driving private sector organisation. So, do I think anything much is going to happen? Well, watch this space, but don't put your money on it.
Okay, David, you know I have to ask you.
Well, I thought, Michael's had the experience that he describes. I think there are two, and I understand his argument. I think there are two reasons why I'm a bit more optimistic than he is. And the first is that the endless chopping and changing that he describes, I think, has largely stopped. We did get rid of the RDAs and replace them with the LEPs. I plead guilty on that. But in general, I think Peter Mandelson picked up in his final year or two where Michael had left off. And a lot of the structures that were created then we can still use. I mean, this week we've had the announcement of the British astronaut going into space and we've been able to make a significant advance in our overall space industry, which is not really dependent on manned space flight. Some of the structures for that, the Space Leadership Council, which is a kind of version of your triple helix, it brings business, government and the research community together, was created under the previous government and I've been happy to use it. I inherited something that worked. So we haven't completely torn up the old structures. David Sainsbury created the Technology Strategy Board aimed at bridging the gap between academic research and commercialization. We've kept the Technology Strategy Board and are using it. The catapult centres that we're implementing were recommended by James Dyson for us in opposition. They're also recommended by Herman Hauser in his report and the final year of the Labour government. So there is more, neither Vince nor I is preoccupied with tearing everything up, reorganising them, starting again. So there is, I think there's a bit more hope for institutional continuity. And secondly, I think that the Citi deal is a very powerful device. And the the ability of cities to secure not all the combined pot of funding that Michael wants, but quite a big combined pot of funding. I think the city deal process doesn't get the attention and coverage it deserves. I think it is one of the more effective ways we've had, I would say, in post-war Britain, of trying to reconstitute these proud cities that Michael described so eloquently in his report.
Thank you. Angus, you touched on the role of the TSB in your presentation. I mean, do you have any observations in terms of, you know, from our perspective within the business schools, how effective are these different relationships?
I think they're a set of relationships we need to get better at. We need to get better at managing. I'd almost want to reflect. I think two themes cross my mind. One is David made the comment of the purpose for business schools, the role for business schools, the role for universities. I think we need to be quite clear about what they are and revisit those roles. And in a sense, go back to the founding of Birmingham, go back to the founding of the civic universities, the fact that they were part of their region. Somebody mentioned a few weeks back something that really struck me about 1992 and the removal of the binary divide, that there was a danger there. One of the consequences of that was a detaching of the politics from their regional base, because they were no longer run as closely by the city. I think that detachment is something that we need to work very hard on to get back. Because my last point would be, think about the durability of institutions. If you look in most cities, even more than the regional authority, universities are the longest, the last man standing, if you like, institutions. Rightly or wrongly, we've demonstrated a degree of durability. We need to work with the new organisations, the new kids that are on the block. But I would encourage policymakers, I would encourage government to look at what role universities and within that business schools can play as these very durable institutions that, depending on how we frame their mission, must have a key role in this in the region.
And actually, finally, Mike, I mean, what's your observation on the ground within ALEP? How do you work with these different organisations?
I can only speak for Manchester, and I have kind of no interest in anywhere else in many respects.
No, that's good. All right.
And we will do it our own way, which is right and proper for the local needs. If you go back 6 years ago, we pulled in a lot of academics, and he was led by Jim O'Neill from Goldman Sachs, to produce a report to Manchester, not a report for Manchester, but a report to Manchester called the Manchester Independent Economic Review. And it told us in 7 chapters, some very hard-hitting things in there about what Manchester needs to do to basically pull its socks up and start punching its weight, because we were punching well below our weight. And it told us what the challenges were about economic deprivation, around skills, around investment, a whole series of things. So we couldn't say no to it, because it was a report to us. We've retained each of those organisations, each of those individual people, including Jim O'Neill, who still worked as a bit of work for us and regurgitated the strategy a few months ago, actually, in light of the kind of current economic circumstances. And that forced us then, the universities and the business schools and the private and public sector, to get together and say, what is our combined response to this? And together we created the Greater Manchester Strategy. And we all signed up to it. Nobody signed a bit of paper. It did not need bits of paper to be signed, because people change. Actually, that's one thing in Manchester that doesn't very often happen. The business leaders and the civic leaders have been around for some time, so they have trust, experience, track record of being able to say, I said I would do, and I did. And that is hugely important in Greater Manchester. So the universities got involved. And actually, if I rang them up tomorrow and said, I'm having a meeting in the office on Friday to discuss transport, all 4 universities would say, what time do you want us there? Genuinely, it is as simple as that. They come along, we argue, we fight, we in private rooms we'll do it anyway, and then we'll create the strategy. And we're now consulting around our skills for the next 15 years, around our transport initiatives, around housing, around low carbon, around the things that we need to grow our economy locally. And do you know what? That would be very different to Liverpool's needs in some respects, very different to Leeds in some respects. But the core about getting together, collaborating, trust, and working together and listening
is huge. And the final bit of that is we made sure we understood what the assets were in Manchester. Because the university, we made them all go away and work out what is your contribution to the economic prosperity of Greater Manchester. And they worked it out. And when a university comes back and says it's £2.5 billion, you sit up and take notice. And how do you leverage that £2.5 billion when you've got 40,000 alumni around the world? Boy, do I want to contact those 40,000 alumni, because they, as I said before, are our greatest sales force out there in the rest of the world. And when we talk to them, they all say, bring it on. Tell us what we need to say out here in China, in Mumbai, in Brazil. They want to engage and help sell Manchester and the UK.
Thank you very much.
Much ahead of, I think, anywhere else, frankly.
Well, I think that I started off today by saying that actually we were probably going to end up asking more questions than we had answers today. And I think that's actually probably true. But at the same time, I think, certainly from my perspective, I've learned a huge amount actually today. And actually, I've got a whole series of things that I need to go away and actually find out some more about, particularly in terms of what's going on in Manchester. I think we've had some very clear invitations today. We've had invitations from David. We had an open invitation to stand up and take our action into our own hands. We've had invitations to actually engage. And that's something which we all in this room need to take forward. For those people listening on watching online, we need to take forward. And as an association, we will be taking forward. We've set out a series of things, some of which have been mentioned today and some of which we'll be setting out in a bit more detail in partnership with other bodies going forward in the next few weeks. As I said when I started off my introduction again this morning, and as David picked up, this is very much a live document. It is a document which itself will evolve. It's a framework, hopefully, for some coordinated action, which is one of the things that we've been focusing on in this last session. So I think that that's probably enough in terms of where we are for this session. Can I thank Lord Heseltine and David and Mike and Angus for their time and their contributions. We're now going to have a refreshment break. We'll be back at 4 o'clock for the seminar sessions. The refreshments are served outside. Seminar one is in here with Mike, so you can find out more about Manchester in here. Seminar two is in Renew the room, which is over in the foyer. Seminar three is in the Sustain room, where we had lunch. And the seminar four is in the Energy room, which is on the other side of the foyer. Thank you for all of our online viewers for listening in. Seminar one, which is in this room, will be broadcast to you. If you carry on, you hold on after the refreshment break. Can I thank the Financial Times for supporting this conference? I'm delighted that everybody here can attend and everybody online. I hope you've enjoyed and you found this hugely valuable, certainly as much as I have. There is an evaluation form in your pack. Please, can you fill it in? Thank you again to our speakers, and let's give them a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.